OYOTU.com.
Sign Language with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 137 of Sign Language. Apologies for the extended delay between episodes. As I said when I, kicked this back off, that if I had nothing to talk about, I wouldn't waste your time. So I am sticking to that, and I hope you appreciate that for what it is. Last night, I was sitting here on Facebook, and I got a message from Bill Venzel. And Bill has been a listener to Sign Language for a long time. Goes right back to the beginning of Sign Language, as far as I know. And he sent me this message, and he said, "Hey, Bruce, first off, thanks for the revitalized Sign Language. It makes me happy when I see a new episode show up in my iPhone's podcast subscriptions. I really enjoyed your last episode, especially the discussion of the conscious versus subconscious ABX testing article. I've got a few topic suggestions for future episodes. 1. Crest factor. What is it, and what is its importance? 2. Your view on audio players, such as iTunes, that now use volume leveling technologies, such as Soundcheck, to make songs in a playlist play back at an even volume. Which are good, bad, effective, ineffective? Will they help end the loudness wars? I guess this is somewhat a follow-on to your recent discussion of broadcast level standards. 3. Your current home studio. Any updates since the old Sign Language days? I'd be into a hardware geek out episode. Thanks again for all your work and knowledge sharing. I'm looking forward to the next Sign Language. Bill." Well, thank you very much, Bill. I appreciated the input. Obviously, 5 weeks have gone by since an episode, so clearly I was shy on ideas of things to talk about. So I was quite happy to see your message come through on Facebook. Okay, crest factor. That's a good one. You can get pretty hardcore with the maths with regarding crest factor, and I will put a link in the show notes to the Wikipedia article on crest factor. But for me, as a working professional, first of all, a description. What is it? Crest factor is essentially the ratio between the peak values in an audio signal and the RMS value of that audio signal, as in the average RMS value. So, we've discussed, peak versus RMS quite a lot on Sign Language over the years. If I was to take, for example, a raw spoken voice performance of anything, whether it was a commercial read or an audiobook narration or whatever, if I was to track that with voice talent without any compression on the signal path, just, microphone, cable, mic preamp, channel fader into DAW, right, with no processing whatsoever, depending on the voice talent concerned and depending on what it was that they were reading, there's going to be a natural, quite diverse range of dynamic between the loudest parts of the performance and the softest part of the performance. That's just natural. As human beings, we modulate our voice to bring interest to certain bits or to raise awareness to other bits. And that's just how we communicate. So when we record a spoken voice without any dynamic control, we leave all of the dynamic control to the performer. And to anyone who has not had experience behind a microphone, their dynamic control is all over the shop, right? They'll go from a mumble to, quite harsh, excited levels. And quite possibly have, a range of, 30 dB between the softest parts and the loudest parts of their delivery. Now, like I said, the amount of experience a person has will tend to bring with it over time some control to that dynamic. You find, really good voice actors who, do it for a living. And they have amazing control over the dynamic of their voice. They can still get, that difference in delivery between where they want it to be soft and where they want it to be punchy, you know, when they want to get your attention with something, but they can still do it in such a way as they control the actual dynamic, like in terms of the waveform, not that a voice artist cares about the shape of the waveform, but there's a control that comes with just years and years of doing it. It's like anything that you do, you know, you do it long enough, you become exceptionally good at it, you know, and you learn the ways to control every nuance of it. It doesn't matter whether it's a sport or whether it's, you know, reading behind a microphone or mixing songs or whatever, you know, anything you do long enough, you will become exceptionally controlled at in the way you perform that task. So just as an example, you know, we might have a very dynamic vocal delivery, whether it's spoken or sung or whatever, doesn't matter. It's quite possible that the average RMS of that signal could be down around minus 20 dB, right? But the peaks, assuming, I know I said we were tracking without any processing, but let's say we put a peak limiter in just to catch any spikes that might have exceeded 0 dB full scale, and we didn't want a clip going to our hard drive. So we put in just a safety peak limiter, you know, and let's say that peak limiter just caught a couple of the spikes. So what we've got are peaks that are hitting, you know, minus 1 dB, right? And there's just a couple of occurrences in the course of our, you know, the delivery of whatever this performance was, they hit minus 1. So essentially what we've got is a crest factor of, well, I don't know how you express the numbers scientifically. For me, I just think of it as 19 dB between the peak value and the average RMS value, right? Now, on the other hand, if we take something like an electric guitar that's running through, you know, a compression pedal and into an amplifier, it would not be uncommon to find, you know, a peak value of, say, minus 12 and an average RMS of maybe minus 15, right? So there's only 3 dB between the absolute peak value of the waveform and where the average RMS of that waveform is. So I would refer to that as 3 dB of crest factor. And so... To me, as a producer of radio commercials, what I am looking to achieve when I'm mixing is, and I'll confess, I use a template for my radio commercial production. I mean, you know, when you're doing it 40 hours a week, you're going to streamline your process as much as you can, right? No sense having to reinvent the wheel every single time I start a new commercial. So I do have a template. And the way my template is set up, and I think I've mentioned this in the past, at the Australian radio network where I'm working, we use Steinberg's Nuendo, which is kind of like Cubase on steroids. On my master channel, the very final slot in my effects slots is set with a plug-in for a VU meter. Now, we can discuss how accurate of a digital VU meter is going to be, but in theory, the VU meter plugin has been engineered to respond with a 300 millisecond average time like a real VU meter would do. Okay, the slot immediately prior to that VU meter plugin is a Waves L3 peak limiter. Okay. Actually, no, these days I'm using the L316 peak limiter. It doesn't really matter. It's a peak limiter, and I've set the output, like the final output level, to minus 1 dB. Now, what comes prior to that doesn't really matter a great deal. There is a compressor immediately prior to the peak limiter, but that's neither here nor there. What I'm aiming to do is to have the digital VU meter plugin showing me that my mix is averaging around 0 VU. Now, in the digital realm, that really means that the average RMS is probably down around minus 12, minus 14. that will all depend on how much compression is being applied to the complete mix, because the amount of compression will alter the crest factor between the average RMS and the peaks of the signal. And that will be determined, to a finer point, by the attack time of the compressor and by the ratio of the compressor. You know, for the guys who are working in TV, they have to, certainly here in Australia, they have to aim for minus 24 dB full scale as an average, right? Now, I look at that as a radio guy and think, wow, that is extremely conservative. What am I ever going to mix that's going to have an average RMS of minus 24 dB full scale and yet still have peaks of minus one? Probably nothing. I'm never going to mix anything that's that dynamic, because I mix for radio commercial production. You know, it's a, you know, it's a very finite niche of audio production. The reality is, the reason that the TV guys have such a wide crest factor to play in is because, you know, when you're mixing TV shows, you quite often have much greater dynamics, you know, within any given scene. You know, you can go from two people talking, having a conversation, to suddenly there's an explosion. You know, in that kind of environment, yeah, you really do need that much of a crest factor to play with so that you can have an average short-term level that sits around minus 24, and then when your explosion happens, it can be much louder than that, but it can still respect the minus 1 dB full-scale peak threshold. And to be honest, I haven't gone completely into this whole short-term loudness thingamajiggy that TV now plays by. I know they're allowed to exceed the average of minus 24 for a certain period of time. And they have all these, you know, weird algorithms that are used to calculate how much they exceed that average by and over what period of time and what's legal and what's not legal. And throughout the whole lot, there's a maximum peak loudness, which I don't think it's 0.1. I think it's like half a dB below full scale. But yeah, so that is the idea of crest factor, that the ratio between the very loudest peaks in your audio signal and the average RMS of that signal, right? So the average RMS, like I've said before, it's calculated on about a 300 millisecond window, which is kind of like a moving average of the, you know, the apparent loudness of a signal over a 300 millisecond window through time. Yeah, I hope that makes it clear, Bill. I mean, you probably already knew and you just wanted to hear my take on it. Like I said, I couldn't quote all the numbers for you from the Wikipedia article. I say anyone who's seriously interested in the science of it all, by all means, go and have a read of that. And if you understand it, come back and explain it to me. But, you know, for me, it's certainly something that I think about when I'm producing stuff, particularly if I get asked to produce a finished spot using material that's been recorded by somebody else. See, 99% of what I produce in my day job, I'm controlling pretty much the recording of, well, certainly all of the voice elements. I mean, obviously, yeah, we use production music, which is, you know, mass produced by production music companies for use in radio, TV, and cinema advertising. You know, and I just mix that music at a level that works for the commercial. Sound effects, again, we're using pre-bought, professionally recorded sound effects libraries, like Hollywood Edge, you know, and a multitude of other libraries like that. But all the voice parts are generally recorded by me in my studio. Now, every once in a while, a voice part will be sent to me by somebody else. Could be that it's a commercial that's come through at the last minute. We haven't had time to book, voice talent to come in to record it, so we've sent the script off to voice talent who are going to record in their own home studio and then deliver the WAV file to us over the net. things like that. So there are a multitude of ways. Or it might be that a commercial has been produced externally, but it runs 25 seconds instead of 30 because there is meant to be a 5-second local tag added to the commercial. That's not uncommon. Someone who's, for example, touring a show around the country might produce a 25-second commercial, leave 5 seconds of either music trail out at the end or just dead air at the end, where that 25-second commercial could be sent to a multitude of markets, and then each market can put a tag on the end that says, you know, this show appearing at this venue on this date, tickets available from this, you know, vendor. That sort of thing is quite common. So in an instance like that, I will get a pre-mixed 25-second commercial, and then I've just got to get someone to record the 5-second tag and then mix it together. Now, again, I need to look at the level of, you know, what's come to me in a finished mix, and then I've got to record with a voice talent a tag that's going to go on the end of that. Now, the tag that goes on the end of it obviously is still very very dynamic at the time that I record it. But what I've got to do is then match the amount of compression and peak limiting of the tag to try and match the style of production that was applied to the first 25 seconds of the commercial, so that I end up with a 30-second commercial that at least, you know, feels cohesive. You know, there's nothing worse than having this highly compressed, you know, 25-second, you know, commercial, and then this really uncompressed dynamic tag on the end. Now, sure, the on-air processing is probably going to deal with it reasonably well in real time, but I'm a bit of a perfectionist, so I want everything that leaves my studio to be as consistent as possible. So, you know, those are the kinds of issues. And you know, I don't really think about crest factor in a conscious way. I guess I've been doing this so long now that it's just something that it's just part of my workflow. Let's try and match the dynamic of everything, so that what we finish with, you know, our finished 30-second mix is consistent in its dynamics, in its peak levels, in its average levels, etc., etc., etc. Hope that makes sense. If you ever want me to discuss more about my approach to mixing commercials, I'm happy to do that, but it probably isn't that relevant to very many people because not many people do what I do. But anyway, okay, so moving on to Bill's second topic, which was about the auto loudness algorithms that are now being rolled out in things like iTunes. To be honest, Bill, you won't catch iTunes on my computer. Not a chance. I am absolutely not a fan of anything Apple does. I've heard people say that iTunes is absolutely awesome on a Mac. And I will have to give those people the benefit of the doubt. All I know is that on a PC, iTunes is the worst piece of crap I've ever come across. It is such a resource hog. It is slow. It is clunky. It is awful. I hate it. I will not go near it. I personally use Media Monkey for my music collection. Media Monkey is much more robust than iTunes. I find iTunes, once you get past about 10,000 tracks in your library, it slows down. It's just shocking. It's horrible. Media Monkey, I think I've currently got about 150,000 tracks in my library of stuff here on my system at home. That's a combination of music as well as sound effects. And the thing I like about Media Monkey is you can set up, inside your master library, you can set up essentially sub-libraries, if you like. So I can classify a collection that is called music, and I can classify a different collection that's called audiobooks, and I can classify a separate collection called sound effects. And each of those will only view, you know, that content which fits into that category. So even though the entire library has 150,000 tracks in it, if I go to music, I'll only see the 70 or 80,000 music files that I've got, right? And then if I go to the sound effects collection, I'll only see, you know, the 50,000, you know, sound effects that I've got. And then if I go to the audiobooks, there's, you know, maybe 10,000 tracks there. So, yeah, I personally am big fan of Media Monkey. And Media Monkey has its own auto-leveling playback algorithm, and I have no idea how that crap works. I know that within MP3 playback, there is an option to multiply or divide every sample value by a certain figure, and it essentially equates to a 1.5 dB increase or decrease of the volume of the playback of an MP3 file, but that's only for MP3. So how Media Monkey does it, I'm not sure. It obviously uses something like that, but it's not limited to only MP3s. Because Media Monkey will play, you know, a whole range of different file formats, not only audio file formats, but video file formats as well. So I'm not sure how any of these loudness-based algorithms work. Clearly, they use some form of scanning the entire file, as in, you know, a song, and working out the average RMS for that song, and then either boosting or attenuating the playback value for that track so as to meet a predefined target. Now, in Media Monkey, the default is set to 89 dB. Now, I'm not sure how they come by this figure of 89 dB. Clearly, that's meant to be a sound pressure level, but how you define a sound pressure level inside the digital domain is beyond me, because sound pressure level comes down to at what rate are speakers exerting themselves on the air in front of them. Because sound pressure level can only be measured in the analog domain, you know, this side of the speakers. But anyway, for whatever reason, it seems that a few different software developers have followed the same idea, because I know that there's a piece of software called MP3 Gain, great little utility, which you can use for normalizing all of your MP3 files so that regardless of what player you put them in, they will all play back at a common RMS average, and again, meeting this supposed target of 89 dB, whatever that's meant to mean. So this idea of normalization of MP3 playback has been around for a while, and I love it. I have MP3 Gain, and I generally throw all of my MP3 files at it. And what it does is it measures the average volume, you know, the average RMS of the track, works out how much that RMS is above or below the target value, and it then writes into the header of the MP3 essentially a multiplier which automatically sets a playback level for that MP3, and it's kind of destructive in the sense that you're applying that value to the MP3 file, but it's simply some text in the header, and it can be removed later on if you want the MP3 to play back at its original amplitude. You ask the question, which one's good, bad, effective, ineffective? I honestly don't have enough experience with all of the variants that are in the market to be able to answer that authoritatively. Will they help end the loudness wars? I sincerely hope so, Bill. I really do. We're still going to have the loudness wars for a while, but I honestly do believe that more and more artists are becoming aware of what the loudness war is and why it's detrimental to their music and to the enjoyment of their music by their listeners. And that can only be a good thing. The more that artists appreciate this, the more they will push back against it. At least that is my hope. And I do think that you know, having normalized playback out of things like iTunes will start to encourage artists to push back against it, because, you know, against the idea of excessive peak limiting. Because once, you know, the idea of make my song louder so that it sounds more appealing, once that argument has been removed from the equation, then there's nothing to be gained by excessively peak limiting, because all you're doing is crushing that crest factor. You're still going to come back with an average RMS that is exactly the same as the track that played before your track and exactly the same as the track that's going to play after your track. And having excessive peak limiting just means that, you know, the guy before you who didn't crush his track will still have peaks at minus one, and your peaks are going to be, you know, only 6 dB higher than your average RMS. So, you know, there's certainly an argument for it, and I sincerely do hope that, you know, the loudness wars are on the decline. I certainly do see more and more artists talking about this in the forums that I frequent around the web. So, you know, the end is nigh, or at least I'd like to believe so anyway. I don't think it's going to go away overnight. And certainly, there's a good 20 years of music that got destroyed by the loudness wars. I think pretty much everything that came out through the 90s and the noughties got mashed, you know, by excessive peak limiting. And hopefully, somewhere down the track, someone's just going to wake up and go, you know what? There's a bucket load of money left on the table that we can rake in by going back to all those great albums that got absolutely hammered by peak limiting through the 90s and the noughties, and by reissuing them with some dynamics. I mean, how many times have you heard people bitch and moan about the quality of Red Hot Chili Peppers' Californication? You know, now I'm not a huge Red Hot Chili Peppers fan, and I've not heard that album in its entirety. But by all accounts, it's a great rock and roll album, but it was destroyed by mastering. That some of the kick drums in there just sound horrible because the peak limiter clamped down so hard that it drove the bass notes of the kick drums into just horrible square wave distortion. I'm guessing there's probably a lot of people who really love Red Hot Chili Peppers who would love to hear that album not crushed by peak limiting. And I think, you know, the record companies, for all their bitching and moaning about the digital crossover and the digital delivery of music, they could potentially rake a lot more money off the table by going back, reissuing a lot of those albums that were destroyed, in a more dynamic presentation. You know, just go back and go, you know what, let's be sensible about this. The loudness war's over. There were no winners. There were only losers, and those losers were the consumers. Look, I've said it. Whether it'll ever happen, I don't know. We can only hope, I guess. And I'm sure, you know, each of us could name a bucket load of our own personal favourite albums that we wish had not been crushed by excessive peak limiting. You know, there were, like I said, I reckon there was a good 20 years where pretty much everything was destroyed. Anyway, each to their own. And as to your third point, your current home studio, any updates since the old sign language days? I'd be into a hardware geek out episode. Sorry to tell you, mate, but every time I've upgraded a piece of audio hardware, I've always talked about it. So, no, I don't think there have been any hardware upgrades since I last spoke about any hardware upgrades, which was probably 3 or 4 years ago. I will turn around, and forgive me for moving the microphone while I'm recording, but just so that I can look at my rack, I'm still using my AEA R84 ribbon mic, which I absolutely love. It is still running through the AEA TRP ribbon preamp. The TRP stands for the ribbon preamp, which is a beautiful two-channel preamp that was designed specifically for, you know, the AEA ribbon mics, simply because ribbon mics need a lot of gain. If you're soft-spoken, and most of the time I am, I'm not excessively loud in my vocal delivery, so I have the gain on this thing wound pretty much flat out. Not all the way to the roof, but pretty close to it. I need all the grunt that this thing has. My old Focusrite preamp, which is still sitting in my rack and unused, hasn't been switched on for ages, did not have enough grunt for me to get a signal through it out of this ribbon microphone. Below the TRP is the 8-channel hardware component of my sound card, which is an M-Audio Fast-Track Ultra 8R, R for the rack unit version. It's a beautiful unit, and I sadly never get to use it to its full capacity these days. When I bought it, it was because Dave and I were recording drums, you know, and I needed 8 inputs. These days, I'm pretty much it. You know, I get the occasional voiceover client who comes to my house and I record them reading commercials, and I then edit those voice tracks into finished commercials and then cut those commercials into a finished demo tape for them so that they can go out and hawk themselves as voiceover talent. And that's pretty much the limit of the use of my sound card here at home. Immediately below that is one of my two most prized pieces of audio hardware, and that's my API 5500 four-band parametric EQ. This thing is absolutely gorgeous. Gorgeous. I love it. And yes, the voice you're hearing now is running through that API EQ. It is just a beautiful unit. I love it to pieces. Immediately below that is the second of my two most highly prized pieces of audio hardware, and that's my Safe Sound Audio Dynamics Toolbox. As a brand name, Safe Sound Audio just sounds horrible. I think it's a horrible name. It reminds me of the first time my cousin rang me and said, "Oh, mate, I've heard about this new audio editor. You're going to love it. It's got a crap name, but you're just going to love it. It's called Cool Edit." And I went, "Cool Edit? What?" You know, another example of great product, really horrible name. So Safe Sound Audio, you know, I think it's a horrible name, but their Dynamics Toolbox, which is essentially a compressor and peak limiter, it's a beautiful piece of gear. I love it. Not cheap, although, having said that, it's about half the price of the API EQ. But yeah, my Dynamics Toolbox, love it. Beautiful, beautiful compressor. Has the ability to run in dual mono or stereo, has sidechain. And I think... because it's not a function I use, I'm pretty sure if I went and looked in the instruction book, you can actually set it up, I think, to use the two channels as a two-channel mono multiband. So you could run one compression circuit for bass frequencies and one compression circuit for treble frequencies if you wanted to do that. But like I said, you would then only get a mono signal through it because you're using your two compressor circuits, you know, for high and low frequency rather than for left channel, right channel. Below that is my Marantz PMD580 flash recorder. Again, this is a 19-inch rack unit mounted box, and it just records to CF cards. Exactly the same type of CF card that you would use in a camera. And I bought this when my DAT machine died. Now, I bought my DAT machine back in the early 90s. It was a Tascam... What was it? Oh, I can't remember the model number now. RA20? Does that sound right? TD20, maybe. I don't know. Whatever it was, it had a 20 on the end of it. Anyway, it was a good DAT machine. And it ran and it ran and it ran until... 2005, 2006, I guess. And yeah, when it died of old age, I thought, well, while I thought DAT was the best thing ever when I bought that in the early 90s, over time and as my audio education progressed, I realized that the downfall with DAT is that it only recorded at 16-bit. And in these days, we would prefer to have higher bitrate audio for... We would prefer to have higher bit resolution for our audio whilst it's in a workflow environment. You know, we really only want to go to 16-bit when we are finished the production workflow and we're presenting a final mixed product. So I thought, well, I really want something that can record at a higher resolution than just 16-bit. So it made sense that rather than go and buy another DAT machine, and let's face it, why would you buy a DAT machine these days? You know, it's a linear format, so you've got to rewind and fast forward. Why would you do that? You just wouldn't. So I looked around for a good flash-based recorder. Love the Marantz gear. Marantz have always made really good recording units. So ended up going with the PMD-580. I can record it at 48. Yeah, I don't think it goes above 48K, but to me, that's really not that big an issue. Most of what I do is at 44.1 anyway, but it does allow me to work at either 16-bit or 24-bit. I can record in stereo or in mono. I can record in WAV or direct to MP3 if I so desire. So if for some reason I really, really, really needed lots of recording time, I could set the unit to record direct to MP3, you know, and I could set it to, you know, 320 kilobit stereo if I wanted to. And out of a 4 gig CF card, I would get hours and hours and hours of content. It would be stupidly long. And because it's just a dedicated unit, it's not like a computer, there's nothing else running in the background. It's just one unit doing one job, and that's capturing audio and storing it as bits on that CF card. I can be doing anything I like on the computer and know that that thing isn't going to fail. It's just as reliable as a tape machine. It captures every bit that comes in. There are no dropouts. There's no glitches because I asked the computer to do something else at the same time and it couldn't handle two things at once. So, you know, it's just a great unit. And for things like Shutters Inc., my photography podcast, where I record a Skype call with my co-host, I actually record that podcast directly to the Marantz, and then when we finish recording, I bring that CF card into my card reader on the computer, drag the WAV file across to my hard drive, and then I mix and edit in Reaper after the fact. But I record to the CF card in the Marantz because I know that I can be doing stuff on the computer and not have to worry about, you know, there being any interruption to the flow of audio data to the card, because it's a completely separate unit. So I can be looking at websites, I can be doing things on Skype, I can be looking at Facebook, I can be retrieving comments from people, and we can be talking about them as we record, and I don't have to worry about any problems. So that's the Marantz PMD-580. Love it. Below that is my now sadly disused and cobweb-riddled Focusrite VoiceMaster Pro, which is a beautiful unit. It's like five or six units in one. If you think of Isotopes Ozone, it's kind of like that in a box. Not quite. Maybe it's more like Nectar. I've never looked at Nectar, but maybe it's a bit more like Nectar. You've got a mic preamp with a de-esser, a noise gate, a compressor, an EQ circuit, an exciter, and then a peak limiter, and then a headphone output with a good headphone amp in it. And you've also got a mix control, so you can actually send a signal in through the back of the unit if you want to mix your vocal with some other, like it might be you're playing a music performance in and you're wanting to sing along with it. You don't want to record the music, you just want to record your voice, but you can send that music signal in almost like a side chain and mix that in on the headphone socket. Yeah, there's a little mix knob between your mic preamp at one side and the, you know, sort of like the auxiliary input at the other end, and anywhere you swivel that knob in between, you adjust the ratio between the two. So it's kind of a handy feature to have, I guess, but not something I've ever used. And then the final thing in my rack is my Alto headphone distribution amp, an HPA4. They are a budget brand headphone preamp. Like I said, it's, again, 19-inch rack unit. It's got four headphone channels in it, but it can drive 12 pairs of headphones. So you've got one headphone output on the front panel for each of those four channels, and then an extra two headphone outputs on the rear panel. So the idea is that it's designed for up to four performers. They're all going to get the same mix, but at least they can control the volume of their particular headphone output. There's also a bass and treble control for each output as well. So if somebody's using a set of headphones that tend to be very bright and hyped, they can adjust their tone control to be, you know, a little, you know, less bright. If someone else has got some headphones that are a bit dull, they can turn the brightness up. So it's just a very basic EQ control on each headphone output. But like I said, if you are using the rear panel sockets as well, you know, because you've got more than four performers at one time, then whoever's using, you know, multiple headphones off the same channel output, they're going to get the same volume and tonal adjustment, you know, regardless. So, but, you know, hey, it does the job most of the time. Again, you know, I'm only ever using one channel, and that's the one channel I've got my headphones plugged into while I'm recording these podcasts. But yeah, it does the job. The only other thing which I didn't mention is right up at the top of my rack is a 48 point patch bay. I have one of the engineers from the ABC when I was working at the Australian Broadcasting Corporation back in the noughties. I managed to get this. This was an old 48 point patch bay that they were going to throw out, and I managed to retrieve it, and I then paid this engineer to come out one weekend to my house. I picked up this rack unit from the Australian Radio Network because they were going to throw that out, and I got this guy to come out, and I said, look, these are all the components that I have. What I want is a patch bay, so that I can patch my signal path wherever I want it. So if I want a particular unit in the signal path, I can have it in, and if I don't want it, I can just, you know, patch around it. And he said, well, let's talk about what's your most common workflow. And I said, okay, well, my most common workflow would be my AEA mic into the TRP, out of the TRP into the API EQ, out of the API EQ into the Safe Sound Dynamics Toolbox compressor, out of the compressor into input one of my sound card. That's my most common workflow because I record podcasts every week. So he said, okay, well, what we'll do is we'll design the signal flow through the patch bay so that that workflow happens without any patch cords being inserted. So that's just the default. And I went, okay, right, that sounds good. And then he said, we then, you know, obviously label every patch point. And then if you want to do something that's not your regular workflow, then you use patch cables to override the hardwired signal path. And I went, sounds awesome. So that's what he did. So I now have this 48-point patch bay at the top of the rack, which most of the time has no patch cords in it at all because the hardwired default is exactly what I need most of the time. And on the odd occasion where I do want to change the signal path, I just grab a couple of patch cords and I go, you know, I want to bypass the compressor, or I want to, you know, route this output to that input, you know, that's not my regular thing, and off I go. So there you go, Bill. That is it. On top of that, I still have the Behringer MX2004 to 20-channel mixer sitting on the desk. That is only used as a monitoring point. I never, ever, ever, ever pass a signal through it that would be recorded and reused. It's really just a glorified monitoring post. And then I've got my Genelec monitors, and you know what? They don't even have the model number on the front. It's written on the back of them, and I can't remember what the model number is. They're the mid-size. I guess they stand about 20 centimeters high. Beautiful things. Powered. got their own amps built in, and I love them. And when we moved out of Sydney and up here to Gosford, which I don't know if I've spoken about this. Sorry, I'm just going to move my microphone back to where it was before, so I'm a bit more comfortable. When we first moved up here to Gosford, I had these things sitting on my table. Because when we were in Sydney, I'd built speaker stands and mounted them on the wall. And these speaker stands sat at about ear level when I'm sitting in my chair. And were angled slightly downwards as they came out from the wall. And I had these Genelecs sitting on those speaker mounts. When we got up here, it wasn't really... I just didn't have the time to commit to building wall-mounted speaker brackets that were suitable for these speakers. And because these speakers are powered, they're pretty darn heavy. I'd hazard a guess they probably weigh around three kilos each, maybe, actually, probably more than that. Probably 4 or 5 kilos, which is, what, you know, 10, 12 pounds, something like that. So they're not light. So if you're going to build a wall-mounted speaker bracket for them, it needs to be bloody sturdy. And I just never got around to doing it. And so for the first, I hate to admit this, but for probably the first 2 years that we were up here, I had these things sitting on the table. And I was never, ever happy with the sound of them, even though I ended up grabbing a couple of old CD cases and tilting the speakers backwards and just pushing the CD cases under the front feet of the speakers just to tilt them up a little bit so that I wasn't getting so much boundary effect off the table. It still didn't sound great, and I don't know why I tolerated it for as long as I did. I guess I just got used to it, and eventually I just went, why am I putting up with this? And I got really cranky at myself, and I still don't want to do speaker brackets on the walls for, well, you might remember back in Sydney, I built a couple of clouds that I hung from the ceiling. When we moved out of that house, I took those clouds with me and I brought them up here, and I've got one of them standing behind my table where I'm currently sitting, and it's basically just sitting on the floor but leaning up against the wall, and so it's too wide for me to put speaker brackets where I want them, right? For me to put speaker brackets to the sides of where this cloud is sitting, it would move my speakers further apart, and I don't want them further apart. I've got them at a nice equilateral triangle shape, and to push them wider is just going to upset the stereo image. So I thought, okay, what else can I do? And I ended up going and finding a couple of house bricks. I kid you not. Down under the house that weren't being used, so I brushed all the cobwebs off them, and I've stood them on their ends upright, and sat the Genelecs on top of them. Now, the Genelecs have got rubber feet, so they absorb any vibration through the rubber feet, and the, you know, because a house brick is, again, probably 20 centimeters along its long edge, it's lifted the Genelecs up off the desk by about 20 centimeters. They're not quite at ear height. They're almost, well, the tops of them are just above eye height. The bass drivers are a little bit below ear height, but the tweeters are at about ear height. And it has made a huge difference to the sound of those speakers in this room. So that's pretty much it. That's my hardware setup. It hasn't really changed that much other than, you know, placement since we were in Sydney. Anyway, I've probably waffled on long enough. My apologies. I hope that addressed everything you wanted to hear about, Bill. I know you were kind of thinking that you were going to give me 3 episodes worth of ideas there, and I've just crammed it all into one. Happy to hear anybody's thoughts or comments on any of the preceding. And if anyone else has got ideas for things that they'd like to hear me talk about, please drop me an email, studio@audiotu.com. All right, until I speak with you next, take care.
Sign Language.
Another audiotu.com quality podcast. For previous episodes, check out
signlanguagepodcast.com.
Or search the iTunes Music Store for questions, comments, and feedback. Email studio@audiotoyou.com.